submitted was this one on hope, and a very general topic, but one that has concerned me a good deal in recent years, because it seems to me that the country, maybe the world, and even the church has kind of given up on the future, and that hope, more than some of the other qualities like love and patience and even joy, that hope is the casualty of our day. Now, my observations may be wrong, because I say to myself, I have less hope, or I have greater trouble having hope. And now at my age, 69, than I had when I was 20. And I say, is that because the world has gotten infested with greater problems, and that the prospects for the future actually seem more dim today than they did 40, 50 years ago? Or is it simply because I'm getting old? And it could be. But in any event, I have felt that that it's more difficult in 1975 to look into the future with hope than it was, say, in 1925 when I was in college. But I guess probably that I'm not saying that that's all bad, because I think that back in 1925, at least as far as I was concerned, my basis for hope, the ground for hope, it was not particularly solid. And I think we've gotten rid of some of that false foundation for hope, which in itself, in a negative way, maybe a game. For instance, the Age of Enlightenment, usually attributed to the 18th century or the 19th century, where in the Western world at least, there was the very optimistic appraisal of man, that man was essentially good. All you needed to do was to get rid of some of the inhibitions, which or some of the hang-ups, but the person himself was good at his center. And I remember a statement attributed to Horace Mann, the educator, that if you could teach everybody to read and write, get rid of ignorance, you could close the prisons. And that was a very optimistic note, as if the only reason a person were bad or did bad things was that he wasn't intelligent. He was unable to see the foolishness of doing bad, the inevitable disaster that would be connected with doing bad. And the only reason on that premise, the only reason Nixon got in trouble was that he wasn't smart enough. Well, this optimistic attitude toward man prevailed generally. Now, I realize that the Lutheran Church and the Christian Church in general didn't buy that. They still believed in the fall of man, and that man was a pretty hard character to handle unless God got in there somehow, and that it was very necessary to have restrictions on his baser nature. So you had the need for governments, and you had the need for police, and occasionally you had the need for war, on the premise that that man was a bad actor and not a good one. But there was that great optimism in the Enlightenment, that reason was the essential quality of man, and if his reason were well developed, his will would run along with it. Now, we've had a reversal on that, so that you've got almost a almost a cynicism over against reason, that people behave out of deeper passions than reason, that reason is a kind of veneer. You rationalize your desires, and your desires are not the result of reason. Your desires lie deeper, appetites and inclinations and passions that that set the goal. So that I feel the pendulum has swung much too far the other way now, so that you always talk about gut reactions instead of rational reactions, and that that you live and act out of these passions rather than out of reason. But we had great optimism at the turn of the century about the powers of reason. A second motif that played in was the evolutionary motif, the Darwinian motif. Now, Darwin had no intention to have the theologians and the philosophers pick his scheme and use it. I don't think he intended that. But this idea that we have developed over millennia from primitive to more complex or civilized levels, and it was picked up really by the theologians and the philosophers, so we got the feeling that or had the conviction that history was one, you know, great spiral up, or going up the mountain. You might slip a step now and then, but the movement was up day by day, year by year, century by century, millennia by millennia. We're getting better and better. And that this was in the very nature of history, a kind of Bergson's Elan Vital, a great power that was there that was pushing us on, and all you needed to do was to keep your seat and hang on, because there were powers moving us to a better day. And there got to be in the arena of the church, in Christian thought, the idea that the kingdom of God was, if not around the corner, at least, you know, in the next county somewhere. The kingdom was a growth process. And that was optimistic, generally. But what it did, of course, was to say, well, it doesn't much matter what you do, because there are these forces pushing us on, so that the idea of a crisis was not there. And it was a comfortable idea. Then science had made such great advances, medicine and all fields of science. Medicine conquering one disease after another, lengthening life and making life better. This was obviously a gain and evidence that we were moving on to a better day. Moreover, there hadn't been any major wars. We had the Civil War, of course, but Europe, Bismarck had consolidated the provinces that became Germany, and he had consolidated them with hardly any bloodshed by politics, so that we didn't have any immediate memory of war. And that was that gave cause to optimism. Sir Norman Angell, who later won the Nobel Prize for Peace, but way back in 1910, he released a book called The Great Illusion, in which he argued that in our interlocked world now, it was impossible for anyone to win a war. That is, the victor and the vanquished would both be defeated, would both be the losers. In earlier periods, somebody could win, because you could take their land and make slaves of them, but you didn't need slaves anymore because of the machine, and in consequence, it was folly to fight wars. And there was the implication. I haven't read the book again. I read it when I was in college, but there was the implication at the time that because nobody could win a war anymore, therefore we wouldn't fight wars. You know, coupled with the idea of the Enlightenment, that man was a reasoning animal, and therefore he'd be smart enough not to fight any wars. Well, 1914 came along, and of course in the United States, we had this expansive motif still going, go west, my son. The frontiers were still there. And the demand for man's services was unquestioned. The United States, I suppose more than Europe, had this going for it. And when it comes to being optimistic, and I think we took for granted, too, that every advance in science was a good thing. Any new discovery was evidence of progress and would be an asset for the future. This was almost an axiom. So that the discovery of radio, for instance, I'm young enough, or old enough, to remember how in this South Dakota town we listened to these little crystal sets, and some of you may remember, all you could hear was static with an occasional refrain of music or something. And when you heard that music, everybody got excited. This was a new day. So that we did assume that any discovery, any invention, any advance in science was on the positive side and would herald the coming of the kingdom. Well, then came 1914, and World War I was on us. I was very young then. 1917, we entered the war, and we entered that war on two great slogans: one war to end all wars, one final war to end all wars, and one war to save the world for democracy. We were going to get rid of Kaiser Bill, who stood in the way of this great march of democracy. And, less than 2 years later, November the 11th, 1918, the war was over. And we had saved the world for democracy. We'd gotten rid of Kaiser Bill, and we had finished war. One last war to end all wars. And we rested back on our oars and figured the job was done. The optimism was still there. And the 1920s went on. No subsiding of optimism. There was a great flurry of activity along all lines. And then, of course, we had the economic I don't want to say catastrophe, because it wasn't that, but it was a blow anyway, 1929 it came earlier in the Midwest. I went to college in 1923 from a little town in South Dakota down to Sioux Falls, and that fall in 1923, five of the seven banks in Sioux Falls closed its doors. So the economic strictures were on us, this readjustment. And of course it wasn't until 1929 when the whole thing kind of collapsed and stock market crash. And then we entered the 30s, which in addition to the economic problems that we had out in the Midwest, the food producing part of our country, there was generally widespread drought. In the Dakotas, there were years I remember when my grandfather or my uncle never pulled the binder out of the shed, just let the stuff be there. And then about that time, and those were kind of grim days, but But the optimism was not gone. Not gone. I remember my grandfather, who homesteaded out there in 1870, now an old man. And the lakes were dry, and dust storms, terrible dust storms. Dust would be in the air like snow. So in June or July, you'd have blizzards of dust. They'd turn the streetlights on in the middle of the day. And so it was rough. But I can remember that there wasn't really any loss of optimism about the future. My grandfather, I still remember him saying, "I've seen these lakes dry before." You know, and that was, I can remember how wonderful that was to think, yes, they've been dry before. They're dry now, but they'll be filled with water again, and the good days will come. You have these ups and downs. And I don't remember being depressed, and I guess I don't remember my father, who had a general store, and farmers couldn't pay him. He told me, I remember that he just took the thousands of dollars off the books. He said, "There's no point sending them bills. They haven't got the money. And they've kept me in business all these years. They're my friends. I'm not going to bother them if I can survive." And it was a great thing that after they got on their feet again after some years, most of them came. They'd not had a bill for years. They came and paid. And then about that time, in the 30s, early 30s, it did become evident that we hadn't saved the world for democracy. We'd gotten rid of the Tsar, but instead we had Stalin, and got rid of Kaiser Wilhelm, but we had Hitler. And they got rid of King Emmanuel in Italy, but we had Mussolini. So we realized that we had not saved the world from democracy. And then before the 30s had gone on very far, the war clouds began to gather. It was quite evident. Everybody hoped that might be avoided, but then you had the Second World War. And when the Second World War ended, on those unprecedented punctuation marks, at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, there was no talk then about having fought two wars to end all wars. It was a very dark moment when they talked about the possible third war. And a cousin of mine who's a colonel in the Air Force told me, he said in the Air Force, we talk about the possible third war that would be over in about 2 hours. The two-hour war that might come. For me, I think, while I began being mature enough to understand that all these props that we had for a glorious future were not all that solid, I think I still hung on pretty well to the idea that progress was in the nature of things, almost, until the atomic bomb. And I think at that point I turned the corner and came, I've said at times I came back to the Bible at that time. Because the Bible has never given that idea of history, that history will be an inevitable march toward utopia. The biblical idea is that history is always in a state of crisis. Well, you may not sense it, that is, but it's there. Evil against good, righteousness against unrighteousness, love against hate and indifference, and the tares and the wheat growing together. And the task of the children of God being to manage this enterprise that may be on the brink of bankruptcy at times, but does happen to have some rather solid stock, since God still is around and owns it. But it can be in bad shape at times. So that the idea of crisis re-entered for me at that time. But, and with that, not a very pleasant thing, because it had been much more pleasant to ride the crest to some great day in the future, sitting there and reading a book and smoking a pipe and letting it happen. But now it was evident that it wasn't going to happen automatically. You're going to have to work at this. And even working at it, you're not going to produce something that's perfect. But that need not throw you into pessimism. Now, I think the fight, the problem now for us is to ward off this dark mood that it's all over with. You know, like the dinosaurs, we too are about to disappear. And there are plenty of voices talking like that. And I think that you people who are young, you know, in your 20s, maybe, I don't know, you'll have to tell me, I think you're as likely to throw in the sponge, in a sense, as I am. And I remember my son Peter, when we were, I think he was about 12, he's, what is he, now 30? And so that's, you know, in the 50s, the late 50s. We were riding together, just he and I, for 100 miles or more, and that didn't happen too often. We had a big family, so we usually had a caravan, but it was, and I remember Peter asking me, what chance do you think I and my friends have of living out a normal lifetime? Now, I never would have asked that at the age of 12. And I'm not, I don't think Peter's asking that every day, you know. He isn't in that dark mood. But it struck me almost with a blow that the question would be asked. And I realize that it's there, the question is there. Let me see. What's happened? Now, the fact. Let me move now to trying to deploring the extreme dark mood. It's there. I suppose it's always been there. I think back of. Well, in Macbeth, for instance, where Macbeth says that tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps in this petty pace from day to day to the last syllable of recorded time, and all our yesterdays have lighted fools the way to dusty death. Out, out, brief candle, life's but a walking shadow. A poor player who struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more. It's a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. Now that's a very dark mood. And I don't know what Shakespeare's day was like, but he didn't have the atomic bomb anyway to make him write this line. So it's always been a thing. You know, it's always been with us, this idea. And if life doesn't add up to anything significant, then why not eat, drink, and be merry in whatever grim way you can while it lasts? I get the grimmest extent to which this mood goes, I think, is best pictured in, like, with a fellow in a canoe going down the rapids. He's lost his paddle, or oar, whatever you call them. He hears the roar of the cataract down ahead of him, and knows that it's over. And what he does then is to wolf down his
the food and the wine that he's got, just almost, you know, in a frenzy before the thing is over. Now that's kind of giving up. It's not only kind of giving up, it is giving up. And there's that mood. And almost at a point, an embracing of it. You know, saying, well, if that's all it is, we might as well have a grand time of it. I thought of the statement that a Nobel Prize winner, I don't remember his name, but he was quoted about 3 years ago in the newspaper. He was 80 years old. Somebody said, what would you do today if you were 20? He said, I would go to drugs and fornication. Well, that's to cop out. There's no chance of winning the battle. So you might as well desert, you know, and you might as well have a good time deserting. There is that, I think there is that. Also, there's a preoccupation with shorter goals. I suppose that's always been the case, too. Where you say, well, it's important to get rich. Whatever. Now, that's a short goal. That isn't comprehensive. You can't take it with you, after all. So it hasn't any meaning that is a long-range meaning. But it's a goal. And there's some satisfaction in getting it, in getting there. Like winning the game, even though the game isn't important to anybody. Or having power, being elected to office, just for the sake of being elected to office. You want to win, that's all. What do you want to win for? I don't know why I want to win, but I want to win. You can have short-range goals, I suppose, in many ways. Pleasure. And I think of these people who have resources enough so they can exploit these short goals, like pleasure. Like these people who retire and all they do is travel. And somebody was asked, why do you travel? And she said, well, I just want to get away from it all. And the guy said, well, you've got it all with you. How are you going to get away from it? But these are, you can get absorbed, therefore, with short-range things. And that's a way, kind of a way of plugging your ears to the cataract that's ahead. Now I think with all, and then another thing that contributes to the dark mood, and let's be frank about that, is the tremendous increase in communications. My grandfather wouldn't have heard about a war in Russia or any place in the world for probably 2 or 3 weeks. And then he'd probably read it on the third page of his paper. With no benefit of pictures. The moment anything happens, anywhere in the world, it's in your living room the moment you let it be there. And I've advised my friends, don't turn on the news the first thing in the morning and don't turn it on the last thing at night, because the news is never pleasant. And that doesn't mean you cop out. I have my roughest time is in the morning. I don't normally wake up very fast, but when I wake up, I've had this happen again and again, I wonder if the world is going to hold together today, particularly if I've been reading the papers or the magazines or listening to television very much. And I get out of bed and get some strong coffee and probably read some prayers that somebody else has written, because I couldn't produce a very cheerful one at that day, but time of day. And by the time I get with people, I figure, well, the world will hold together another day, I think. But I don't think it's fair to me, or to you, or to anybody, to have this tidal wave of bad news. And almost all news is bad news. It's the only thing that makes news, kind of.
to report that Mr. Jones demonstrated a great exhibition of patience yesterday. What news is that? If he exhibited impatience and shot somebody, that would be news. So it's generally bad news. And I don't malign communications now. I've got a lot of good friends in communications, and they're in the business of providing us the news. But I also know that I need to sort it out, or I need to take it when I can. And in the morning, the best thing for me to do is to read the comics and the sports page and let the editorials and the big headlines wait until I'm in a little better mood to handle them. But, you know, 50 years ago, there was no talk of overpopulation. There was no talk of world hunger. We've always had famine here and there. There was no talk of destroying a city with a blow. There was no talk of pollution. I never thought of that out in South Dakota. And the only thing I can remember is that London had a problem with smoke. Can't even remember anything about New York. Pittsburgh did. But so all these things are kind of new that have come upon us. And so it isn't strange that we have a rough time. And I think the most striking image that I've heard or read was Franz Werfel, who described the age, our day, in the parable of the camel driver who is being pursued by his enraged camel. And to escape, he jumps into a well. And as he falls, his clothes catch on a root growing out of the wall of the well. And there he hangs, suspended. He looks up and he sees the maddened eyes of the camel looking down upon him. He looks down into the bottom of the well and he sees the fiery eyes of a dragon. And as his eyes get used to the light, he notices that there are two mice, one white and one black, taking alternate bites at the base of the root. Now, that's a very bad situation. And Mr. Werfel says that man had hoped to be the driver of the machine, but the machine gone mad has turned upon him and threatens to destroy him. And at the moment he faces on the one hand the ungovernable machine, and on the other hand the prospect of some catastrophic death, either the bomb or universal euthanasia or something, where you can't breathe anymore. And in the meantime, time is running out, day and night, the white mouse and the black mouse. Now I say that's pretty dark. But I think that the mood is there, and it's a wonderful thing to come up here here and get away from telephone, television, radio, everything. And it isn't a cop-out. It's kind of catching your breath again or getting your bearings. And I think Holden does a great thing on that score. Now, how do I build up for the future? Well, of course, I have the poker players, I guess, say an ace in the hole. If the whole thing blows, that ain't the end. That's what we're dedicated to as a church, as the Christian church. I've said, after all, we all expect to leave. We all expect to leave trickling out of hospital beds in a lonely fashion. Might it not be more exciting to leave in a gala fashion, all of us together? Because we've never intended to stay here forever anyway. Well, that's and I think of the I always like this. It's attributed to Ralph Waldo Emerson, who his maid had been down on the streets of Boston,
and heard a street preacher say that the world was coming to an end in 2 weeks. And this really scared her. And she hurried back home in a nervous state and told Mr. Emerson about this and said, "What shall we do?" And Mr. Emerson said, don't be so distraught. If it becomes necessary, I think we can get along without this world." And that's one position. But, a kind of vertical future. But I want a horizontal future. And I want it for myself, for the few years that the Lord will allow me to live here. And I want it for my children and my grandchildren. I've got 10 grandchildren. And when I look at any one of them and think, what's it going to be like for you in the next 70 years? It kind of boggles my mind, because I'm told that the changes, the scientific achievements that we've had in the last 50 years will be dwarfed by those that are ahead of us in the next 50 years. And I just can't imagine what that will be like. But I want to believe that there's something good for my grandchildren. And let me put it this way. How do I do that? How do I generate this kind of hope for them, for me? Number one, I have to believe, and I believe, that God is around. That he created this earth, and he put his children on this earth, and he's got a great stake in what happens to them. We're not just mammals. We're much more than that. I also believe that, I want to believe, and I think believe, that God put all these marvelous things in his universe and gave man a mind to ferret them out. And that therefore, these discoveries in science are good and not the hostile things in our lives. I like to think of God being like a father who hides things in a room and tells his kids, "Now stay out of the room, I'm going to hide things here." And then when he's gotten them all hidden, he calls the kids in and has them play the game of finding these things. And I can't help but think that every time a child finds one of them, the father sitting there must be pleased. And that every time we discover some new thing in God's universe. Now, some of the things that he's hidden are pretty dangerous. Improperly used, they're dangerous. Properly used, they're marvelous. So he didn't hide just some bland things around. He hid some good things. Could very well be, using the analogy, that the father would have hidden a .22 rifle. And that this could kill people, but it also could be useful. So I have to take that posture, that the discovery of atomic energy, or the release of atomic energy, despite the great hazards, is a good thing. Number two, or three, or whatever, and I have to believe that God, being in control, yet having given us, his children, the same gift that he has, the freedom of choice, that we're not automatons, we're not puppets. Conditioned as we are by our environment and by heredity and by chemical, biological factors, we still resemble God in the fact that we have freedom, the freedom of choice. And he's not going to take that away from us. We're going to mess things up with it. But he's not going to take it away from us. But like a great good father, he puts limits to our abuse of it, of the gift. Now that's a hard thing for me to say, how does he do that? And when does he do it? When does he say, that's enough. I'm not going to let you do any more damage than that. I don't know. I say I only have to believe that. This is a part of my portfolio of trying to have some hope for the world. Then another thing is I try to be more historic than I think most people are. Our generation, your generation, talking about you younger people, have been accused of dumping history, of getting rid of it. You've said, in effect, that is that you're accused of saying, in effect, that you can't learn anything from your fathers because they made a botch of it. You might as well start something new. But I think it's dangerous not to look at history. And in the first place, you'll repeat the errors if you don't know what the errors were in history. That's one danger. Second is that you will get too dark a picture of the future. The history has teaches us that this today is not necessarily the worst of all days. And that the evils that are today are not necessarily new ones. They've been dealt with before. And they've caused damage before. They have been held in check before. And you stop to think, traveling in Europe, why do you suppose they have all these castles and forts? Is that because it was fun to build castles and forts? It was because everybody was killing everybody else. Every little orbit of sovereignty was out to destroy every other orbit of sovereignty. And I remember in the days late 60s, when there was a great flurry of dissent and in the university world, particularly, and touched the seminary some too. And everybody thought, my goodness, things are falling apart at the seams all over the place. What'll happen to universities and colleges and everything else? And what's this young generation like, this terrible generation? I was cheered, because it's bad to be cheered by bad news, but I was cheered to read about the origins of the University of Minnesota in the early 1850s. And at that time, I suppose in the issues prior to the Civil War, explosive issues. At that time, they closed the university for 2 years because of the dissent of the students, their violence. My grandfather, what a nice guy he was, as I remember him. Could he have been like that, the age of 20? Well, yes, people are like that. And so it's nothing new. Then, fortunately for me, I read a book, I think in the late 60s, early 70s, maybe you've seen the book, Revolution Without Marx and Jesus, by Revel, a Frenchman, who looked at the United States. And it was just at the time that we had so much masochism, we were beating ourselves. And he, from the outside, called attention to certain things about the United States. And said, despite all the violence, and he said there really isn't much of it, you had Kent State, few people killed there, and a lot of dissent, and a lot of marching, and, you know, taking possession of buildings, and those things. They were hard on administrators. But he said, despite that, none of the institutions really are shaken at all. They're sturdy. They stand there. The courts, the government, there's a lot of strength there. And that helped me to kind of compare. And then he said in Europe it was said that the Black Panthers could never get a fair trial in the United States. But they did. And the book was written before Angela Davis, but it was said of the same thing of her. She'll never get a fair trial in the United States with all our prejudice. But she did. And then he said, has there ever been
any nation at any time that in any any decade has made such great strides in legislation over against minorities, in legislation, in the massive scholarships that have been, programs that have been given for minorities, than the United States. There's just no place in the world where it's happened like that. And he said, sure, they've still got problems. And I suppose you never get rid of problems. If you get rid of one, another kind appears. And then this was at the time of, what's his name, this My Lai incident?
Okay.
Cali. He said the Cali incident. That's the first time in the history of the world that a soldier has been tried and convicted by his peers for killing in enemy territory during a war. There's never been that self had ability to come to terms with oneself. And he said the Vietnam War, a very unfortunate thing, but again, there's a degree of self-criticism and a degree of repentance over against the whole involvement that's quite unique in history. And he said, in the United States, you can criticize your foreign policy, by which you criticize your own country over against its relations with other countries. He said, that's hardly ever done in any country. That's like openly criticizing your mother at a party. You don't do that. Well, he had one thing after another where he called attention to the fact that in these United States, with our pluralities of people, and with getting used to each other as pluralities, he said there is an openness. And he said the older generation is listening to the younger generation better than in other countries. So he had all sorts of things that pleased me. And he said he thought that the United States would probably be a model for a profound kind of revolution, not the overturning of institutions, but a shifting of viewpoints for the rest of the world. I don't know how right he is, but I like to hear it anyway. And over against war, that's the big spectacle, I think. I think the danger of war is greater than the danger of hunger or of overpopulation. That is, it could be immediate disaster. I have a friend, Arthur Larson, who was Under Secretary of Labor, and he was one of Eisenhower's speechwriters, a Rhodes Scholar, who's been engaged primarily in international law. And Art said, if we can prevent disaster, by which is an explosion, I suppose, between Russia and the United States, for a number of years, if we can hold back on that, he said, the day may be upon us when war will, in a sense, be an anachronism, that you can't use it anymore. And he said, it's already upon us. He said, always before the atomic bomb, always before, there was the... We negotiated with other governments from the point of strength. You know, you've heard that. We've got to negotiate from strength, not from weakness. And he said that simply meant that if there was a boundary dispute between two countries and the representatives of the two countries came together to negotiate the boundary, you never talked about the boundary. You only talked about who could lick the other if you went to war. And if you could persuade that you could lick the other side in going to war, he got the boundary. Now, he said, you can't negotiate from strength anymore. It's impossible for Russia and the United States to sit across tables and negotiate from strength, because each one knows that to unleash its strength would be to destroy both. So it's a new day
He said, it's a new day, really, in the history of the world. And he said to me that there are more things settled between nations in negotiation now than ever before. He, you know, he was optimistic about the fact that the possession of these tremendously destructive instruments are themselves the guarantee of peace. Now, he said, it'll have to come, that is, it'll have to dawn upon us after a while that since you can't use them, you've got to diminish them. No point piling them up when you can't use them. And so he believes that day may be coming too. Then I read Sorokin's The Crisis of Our Age. Sorokin was a Russian who fled Russia in 1917 in the Bolshevist uprising, and taught sociology at the University of Minnesota for 6 or 7 years, and then went to Harvard, where he spent most of his life. And in this book, written way back in the 30s, but republished now, as Sorokin points, and republished with an addendum by him, where Sorokin says that we have been a sensate society. That is, my satisfactions come from my body, my senses. And what's important about me is that I'm an organism like the chimpanzee or the cockroach or the amoeba, or I belong there where my the meaning of my life is a sensate thing. I'm a child of nature, not a child of a celestial group. The angels and the archangels and the company of heaven, I have no relations with them. I do have relations with the rat, on whom they experiment in the laboratories to find out about me, my lower cousins. Sorokin says, you examine the art, the time of the Renaissance, or immediate, you know, I suppose you'd say the pre-Renaissance or art, Renaissance period, 600 years ago, and all of it is celestial art. Painters draw pictures of the saints and the angels and biblical characters, and so does the sculptor, and the musician creates the glorias and the Kyrie eleisons and the requiems. And law is thought to be a kind of eternal law, or the moral law, or the universal law, equity, a transcendent thing given. That man was thought to be a child, belonged to the angels, and that his life here was, you know, just a brief period after all, in which he shared a probationary period, or he was exiled in the island for a little while until he got back to the mainland. And he said, since that time, we've been moving in this, the discovery of nature and man as a natural, a child of nature with natural rights and natural needs and all of that. We've veered so far away now that whereas 600 years ago, 95% of the art was celestial art, this kind of art, now, about 98% of it is in possession of the advertising industry, telling you what your body needs. And all the way from deodorants to what else. And he said that's run its course now. That's about run its course. He said there are great signs on the horizon that man is on the brink of a new discovery of his spiritual nature. And that he's a creature that belongs not just to chemistry, but a creature that belongs to God. And he says in his book, if we can avoid disaster or catastrophe for another 25 years, he has a feeling that there might be a world resurgence, how it'll come, I don't know, of this assessment of ourselves as spiritual beings. And that in the wake of that, the tensions that are created by wanting to possess the things that the body needs
that tension will be relaxed, and that will have a wonderful effect on the life of the world. I don't know what we do with pollution, overpopulation, hunger, but you have scholars on both sides there. And I remember, I think it was Yugoslavia about 7 years ago, I remember reading in the paper that they tightened their abortion laws because they'd had more deaths than births that year, and they didn't want to be depopulated. I struggle with this and try to find evidences that the future is not as dark as the darker prophets would picture it. And I suppose finally the thing is that man has a great deal of ingenuity. He's bad and he's good, both. And God is around. And I think too that the Christian church, believing as they do in a God who created us and put us here, a God who thought so much of us that he died for us, and a God who has assured us that he'll be around, that we had better, in the teeth of all the dark forebodings, we had better stand up and have a positive posture, even if we're called naive for having it. Well, I think we go to dinner.